Welcome to Thrive Deeper, the show based on the Thrive Bible reading guides. This is an ongoing conversation about God's Word with Thrive author, Dr. Matthew Jacoby.
Hi listeners, Stuart here from Thrive today. You know, many people tune in to a Thrive podcast every week. In fact, over 1,800 people download or listen to a Thrive podcast somewhere in the world every single month. We're really encouraged by the feedback we receive on how these podcasts are impacting people's lives in very real ways and equipping them as they grow in their faith. Now, our hope and desire is to continue to make these podcasts available for free. However, there is a very real cost to make this happen. Rent for our studio, production equipment, web development, site hosting, editing, and more. We want to avoid running advertisements in our Thrive podcasts, but we're also committed to making sure that Thrive is available to our listeners for free. This is where you can help us. If you'd like to contribute to assist us in meeting these ongoing production and distribution costs, then please join our listener support program with a monthly subscription. Now, you can do this very quickly and simply. Just go to thrivetoday.tv. That's our website, thrivetoday.tv. At the top of the homepage, you'll see a button that says Donate. This will give you the option to support the Thrive podcast with a donation of $5 or $10 or $50 per month. You can set your own support level. So we hope you'll consider supporting this ministry in this way. Again, to those who are monthly supporters, a huge thank you to you. Your contribution is helping us continue to provide these Thrive podcasts for free. So it's easy. Visit thrivetoday.tv, click on the donate button. We thank you for your support by tuning in, but also by contributing financially in this way. Now let's jump into this episode of Thrive Deeper with Matt.
Are you a football fan, Stuart? You've been following the World Cup?
Look, a little bit, but yeah. I mean, hey, it was a bit of a heart drop when Tunisia scored a goal against the French, because then it's like we had to win. We didn't have to just draw. And then the goal that got us through.
Amazing. Amazing Socceroos through. But I tell you what, this morning was pretty heartbreaking as a Germany fan. Germany are out. Out at the group stage, which is pretty tragic. But anyway.
Goodness. I think
it's usually the other way around. Usually it's Australia that go out I've still got Germany to barrack for.
Matt, you're going to have to cheer for Australia.
Yeah, that's right. This time it's like, what?
And they're up against it with Argentina, I suspect. Yeah. But anyway. Well, it's great to be back in the studio. We're continuing our journey through the Minor Prophets.
Yep.
Only minor because they're shorter books, not minor because they're any less important. And today we're going to be kicking into the book of Micah. Mm. So this is Thrive Deeper, and we're up to episode 159. And Micah, he was a contemporary of Isaiah and Hosea as well, so around the same time, and we've just been speaking about Hosea not so long ago. But Micah prophesied mostly in the region of Judah, although he did speak to all of Israel, the north and the southern kingdoms. Predominantly, he was speaking in Judah, and he was kind of prophesying across the three kings of Judah, Jotham, Ahaz and Hezekiah. Mm. And again, much like Hosea, this book is written in Hebrew poetry format. And as I was saying, sharing with you before we came on here, Matt, sometimes it's hard to keep reading through because it is so illustrative picture poetry kind of written. It's hard to kind of keep your focus on what's happening. So it's going to be great to work through this with you.
Yeah.
Work through this with you.
The interesting thing with Hezekiah, and as we know, Hezekiah was a godly king. You know, he responded to God unlike a lot of the kings. And evidently, he seems to have been quite responsive to Isaiah, but also Micah. In fact, an example that's used in Jeremiah, in the book of Jeremiah, it says here in Jeremiah chapter 26, and this is about responding to Jeremiah prophecies. What are we going to do about this guy? Is this treason that that Jeremiah the prophet is talking about this? And this is a bit later now.
Yeah.
In fact, it's about 100 years later.
It is.
So it says in Jeremiah 26, verse 17, some of the elders of the land stepped forward and said to the entire assembly, Micah, of Moresheth prophesied in the days of Hezekiah, king of Judah. He told the people of Judah, this is what the Lord Almighty says, Zion will be like a plant, will be plowed like a field. Jerusalem will become a heap of rubble. The temple hill, a mound overgrown with thickets. And then he goes on to say, did Hezekiah, king of Judah, or anyone else in Judah put him to death? Did not Hezekiah fear the Lord and seek his favor? And did not the Lord relent so that he did not bring disaster, the disaster he pronounced against them? We were about to bring terrible disaster on ourselves.
Yeah. And interesting, because Micah and I think Jonah are the only two prophets that are actually referenced by other prophets.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, we actually have them both referenced there. So, you know, Micah actually saw the fulfillment of his prophecies, which we'll talk about in a moment, about the fall of Samaria to the Assyrians. But he also, as you say, he witnessed the great revival initiated by Hezekiah.
Yeah, which and no doubt was part of that. Yeah, no doubt was part of that.
Absolutely spoke into that. And which actually, as you say, delayed God's judgment on Judah and Jerusalem for probably another century.
Yeah, that's right. And
one of the few prophets that were actually heeded. The warnings were actually heeded.
Exactly. I was just going to say So it's, you know, it's interesting because we sometimes read these and you think, oh, you know, no one ever listened to these poor prophets. Yeah. Well, actually, in this case, they did, and, to great effect.
Yeah. Mm. Let's kick in, Matt.
Yeah. I think the best way to look at this is to look at some of the broad themes in this book. And Micah is criticizing a situation in both Judah and Israel. And in a way, Israel is kind of out ahead in terms of corruption and so forth. But Judah is seen as kind of going along with that a little bit. It's a little bit like, oh, you're becoming as bad as your little brother, or something like that, you know, in the case of Judah. But the big problem, and it shows actually how central this is, Stu, to the value, to biblical values, and how central this is to the biblical faith. The concern is with justice and injustice here, and the way that people are treating one another, and particularly the treatment of the poor. That gets a lot of space here. This was built into the Mosaic Law. A really, really important part of the Mosaic Law is the treatment of the most vulnerable in society. And that's a really interesting aspect of the Mosaic Law. It's somewhat countercultural. I mean, there are other laws like the Babylonian Law of Hammurabi that has some provision for the poor, some protections for the poor. But on the whole, nothing close to what we see here in the biblical faith, and so these prophets are really policing this, because you know in times of great prosperity in monarchic systems like this, you've got very class society, and that leads to oppression and exploitation of the poor. And so the exploitation of the poor is actually a symptom of another problem, and that is a symptom of, well, it's a symptom of a problem, which is a symptom of a problem. And the first problem is their relationship with God, of course, is the problem of their gradual disregard for God. Or perhaps you could say, in the case of Judah, probably their faith, that they weren't apostate like the northern kingdom was, but it was a bit of box ticking.
Yes.
You know, we'll do all the right things, go into the temple, because of course Isaiah criticizes both Judah and Israel for just being sort of empty religion as such. So you know they're potentially ticking the boxes and going through with that. Then the thing that interesting thing that gets compromised, the first thing in the law that gets compromised is the law of the fundamental equality. The law of sharing, so God gave them the land, and in an agrarian society, the land is your base, the base of your wealth, and they were to have an equal share in the land. You know, the land was divided amongst them. They were to be more like tenants than owners of the land. God is the owner; they are the tenants, and God gifted the land to all of them. And so there's this strong value. And again, this is something that actually is really quite very unique about the Mosaic Law, is this idea of what almost looks like a kind of communist society, except
It's the perfect form of communism.
Perhaps it's you know, in that they were meant to have this shared existence. Right. You know, the land didn't.
We're all interdependent.
That's right. The land belonged to God. We're tenants. Yeah. We've been gifted it so that we can work the land and so forth. And this communal ideal, of course, as you read through the Old Testament, this communal ideal was never really fulfilled. You know, that's the interesting thing, because that was probably the highest ideal in terms of how the people lived their lives, was this communal ideal. You know, things like, you know, the liberation of slaves, the cancellation of debts regularly at the end of a period, the year of Jubilee in which everything returned to the original share. Land, So what was meant to happen is that if you bought land, you would only have it until that 49-year period had passed, and then it would revert back to its traditional owners.
Yeah.
And that was a way of preventing a society from becoming a sort of a class.
Class system. Wealthy getting more wealthy and the poor getting more poor.
Because that gets entrenched in societies, you know, because then you get this generational wealth you get this generational poverty. Mm. And it's quite amazing, actually, how these elements, the idea of the cancellation of debts, first of all, the liberation of slaves, you know, because, of course, people, once they fell to the bottom side into poverty, they invariably sold themselves into slavery. Mm. So you've got the cancellation of debts, that was a provision in the Mosaic law. You've got the setting free of slaves, another provision. And then you've got, if all of that didn't work, then you've got the reversion of the land to the traditional owners.
And if you think about the message of Jesus, the cancellation of debt, the debt of sin, the setting free of the slaves, and the reversion to relationship. The parallel.
That's right.
Right there as well. So
that's a high ideal. And it was never really fulfilled, in any significant way throughout the whole Old Testament story. And the interesting thing is that Luke goes to pains to show that after the outpouring of the Spirit, the one main fruit of the Spirit that he points out at the end of Acts chapter 2 and then again in chapter 4 is how this early church community, and he's very explicit, shared everything that they had. He's very emphatic about it.
Yeah.
And he shows basically that the early church fulfilled the ideal almost straight away, you know, by the power of the Spirit, as a result of the outpouring of the Spirit, that they fulfilled this ideal that was enshrined in the Mosaic law.
But this wasn't, of course, happening at this time with Micah. And
no, well, it wasn't happening.
We're getting the leaders getting wealthy and the prophets that are actually, you know, almost prophesying what you want to hear for money, and this whole kind of sense of separation between the haves and the have-nots.
Yeah. And this is, it's interesting, this is the thing that they really go for. Invariably, this is, apart from you have forsaken God, the main theme is the inequality.
Yeah.
Is their failure to actually fulfill it, because that ideal was all about creating family. It was the idea of being a family of God's children, the fundamental equality of all people before God. That is, I mean, man, this is the ancient world, Stu. This is so far from anything, you know, at the time. I mean, I think even now we struggle to fulfill it. Yet that ideal is just so... so countercultural in this period, even today, it's pretty countercultural. So this is the thing that the prophets are sort of vociferating against, the injustice.
And really, he covers this in sort of chapters 1 through to the first half of chapter 4. Really, he's talking about, and there's some other aspects to each of those chapters, but he's really talking about this injustice. He's really talking about Israel's leaders taking advantage, that they're violating the Torah, the law, as you say.
Yeah, that's right. And it comes from, it's interesting to note here, because the consistent thing is the root of all of everything is either apostasy, which is, you know, turning away from God and turning to other gods. So it's either this idolatry, or often associated with that is a sort of box ticking. As I said, the box ticking. And it's interesting that it says here in 1:5. All this is because of Jacob's transgression, because of the sins of the people of Israel. What is Jacob's transgression? Is it not Samaria? And then it turns to Judah. Mm. What is Judah's high place? Because just, you know, in case the people of Judah say, they're all idolaters out there. You know, they're all going up to the high places, you know, because pagan shrines were always on high places. Yeah. And so Micah says, what is Judah's high place? is it not Jerusalem?
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
That is a powerful indictment, because it's basically saying you have made Jerusalem. Yes, okay, yep, sure. You go and you observe the biblical faith. You go up to Jerusalem, you offer you the sacrifice, but it's no better than a high place.
It's actually religion.
Yeah. You've just created a heartless, empty religion, and so it's no better than the idolatry of the northern kingdom. It's a pretty powerful indictment.
Sure.
So he goes on to say, he says, therefore I will make Samaria a heap of rubble, a place for planting of vineyards. I will pour her stones into the valley and lay bare her foundations. That is exactly what happened. To this day, Samaria is a heap of rubble. The city was laid bare just a little while, just actually quite a short time after this, by the Assyrians, of course. So, Micah says, because of this, I weep and wail, I go about bare. So, again, this prophetic demonstration, probably alongside of this, in those days, there were very traditional ways in which you mourned and wailed. And so, and he may have done that even with other people as well, made a bit of a thing about it. So, because this is about prophetic signs, right? Mm-hmm. So he's mourning as though something had happened already.
Yes.
Because it's going to happen. So this is often a powerful prophetic moment where it's as good as done, and I'm mourning as though it's already happened.
Yeah.
And so that would have drawn people's attention. Interestingly, Stu, and you mentioned this just before off recording, the special mention of the city of Lachish.
Verse 13,
which was one of the fortified cities around Jerusalem. Mm. Now, the interesting thing is, of course, Jerusalem survives the Assyrian incursions.
Yes.
We know from the story of Hezekiah Hezekiah seeks God, and even as the Assyrians are starting to lay siege to the city, and that pretty much spelt doom. Mm. But Hezekiah cries out for God, and God in that amazing, 185,000 people slaughtered in one night by the angel of the Lord.
Mm.
It says there. Other sources, in fact, there's a extra biblical source in Herodotus that maybe refer to this, that refers to something like that, talks about a plague actually, about the Assyrians in Jerusalem and so forth. So, but Lachish got completely decimated in that campaign in the southern kingdom. So Jerusalem survived, but the city of Lachish, got destroyed. And to this day, actually, the very famous depictions of the siege of Lachish in the British Museum today, these big carvings, and it's carnage, Stu. It's absolutely carnage.
Fiercest battle.
Really. I mean, it's some real gruesome stuff that's depicted, real carnage there in those depictions. So,
but what Mike is saying here, is that this is where, the daughter of Zion or Israel and Judah's errors became, where they started to drift away from God, began here.
Yeah.
And he makes special mention to the decimation that's going to take place there because of that in verse 13. Just for people's help out there too, the Assyrians at this stage, so they were based in probably in the city of Nineveh, which is modern day Iraq, probably Mosul, or in that area anyway. And they'd built a huge empire. They were really the dominating military force at the time. And at the end, when King Hezekiah, as you say, turned to God, but then he made a fatal mistake, of course, of doing a treaty and then he failed to pay. He did a treaty with the Egyptians, and then failed to pay the tribute that he'd agreed to the Assyrians and of course that began the path to destruction for Jerusalem as well. So
crazy. But of course, Lachish is
completely
sort of
destroyed.
Yeah, was completely destroyed, and that Micah is pointing out beforehand that this is because there are a lot of problems here, and this is quite a strong and proud city, and they're thinking, "Oh, we're going to be fine. We're going to be fine." Mm. And he's saying, "No, you're not going to be fine." Mm. So he keeps, he keeps coming back and reminding them of the things. Chapter 2 of God's grievance against them. It's a little bit like the way that this is shaped. at points is like a court case.
Yeah, it is.
In fact,
yeah.
You get this. These are my charges against you. Mm. It's as though he's putting both Israel and Judah in the dock, and what he's wanting to do is deliberately take Judah out of. They're not the jury. Mm. They're in the dock with yeah. Israel. So this is something that Micah does. I mean, and he wants Jerusalem. He wants Judah to actually learn from what's happening.
Yeah.
In fact, there's a sense that what happens to in the Northern Kingdom is going to be a thing, like an example
of what will happen
to the Southern Kingdom, and Mike wants to make that explicit.
Yeah. And of course, because so much of it, as you said earlier on, is talking about the injustice, you know, to actually put it in the framework of a court case, and so let's have a look at the evidence here of the injustice,
yeah.
you know, is kind of really flows well with what the message is actually trying to say.
Yeah, 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 that's right. Yeah. And so it says, beginning of chapter 2, woe to those who plan iniquity, to those who plot evil on their beds, at morning's light they carry it out, because it is in their power to do it. So you've got a very powerful class. So again, remember, there's something that's gone on before this that's led to this. And it goes on to say, they covet fields and seize them and houses and take them. They defraud people of their homes. They rob them of their inheritance. Mm. The continual referral to the inheritance.
It's
Micah is reminding them, this is their inheritance that God gave them, and you're taking that from them. Now, the one of the other interesting features of Micah's prophecies is the frequency with which he comes back to the false prophets.
Yes,
that were functioning, and we know that this was both the case in the northern and the southern kingdom, but particularly in the northern kingdom. So,
and these false prophets were really doing it for personal gain. It was about generating their own wealth, basically. You know, you pay me, and I'll tell you. You know, I'll almost like a soothsayer. It's like, you know, I'll.
You wonder. Yeah. You wonder how that was ever believable.
Yeah. Well, probably because although, as you say, you know, Judah probably wasn't apostate as much, certainly not as much as Israel, probably because that was how those religions all worked. You had to pay to get what you wanted. And so they were just transferring that same principle across to Yahweh, possibly.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. People were used to that. In the other cases, they would practice extirpacy, which is the, you know, cutting open of an animal, things like that. That would be, and they would seek omens, and that's the most common way. And honestly, sometimes that would go for and against, but there's enormous for or against.
Yeah.
But yes, there was pressure to give a good reply, and we know from from the things that these prophets went through and you see this later, for example, with Jeremiah, who gets mistreated terribly because he says, no, you are going to be destroyed. And that's taken as treason.
Yeah.
So these prophets, are wanting to say what
people want to hear.
So in a way, that is a kind of indictment upon them. Like it is kind of stupid, actually, in the sense that you're paying your prophets to tell you something that you want to hear.
Yeah. But these prophets are also speaking on behalf of God, so they're, you know, a fairly serious indictment
and perhaps,
on them as well.
You know, the believability, I'm sure the prophets would have tapped into ideas like God's eternal covenant with Israel and things, you know, and God's past commitments and past stories, all of that sort of stuff. No doubt they would have pointed to that and, you know, given some theological justification for why, of course, you know, that of course God's going to save them and so forth. But still, the Israel and Judah are still blamed for listening to these guys. It's sort of an act of willed self-deception.
Yeah.
You know, you are believing what you want to believe. So it says here in verse 6, do not prophesy, their prophets say.
Yeah.
Do not prophesy about these things. Disgrace will not overtake us. This is what the prophets are saying.
Is the Spirit of the Lord impatient?
Yeah, that's right.
Are these the sorts of things he does? Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. And he goes down verse 11, it says, if a liar and a deceiver comes and says, I will prophesy for you, plenty of wine and beer, that would be just the profit for this people.
That's right. They're just going to tell you what you want to hear.
Exactly. Right. So in a way, he's saying, can't you see that this is rigged, right? Now, the interesting thing, though, is that, you know, their prophecy, you know, they are being, these false prophets are being listened to because they're prophesying it's favor, favor, favor. Mm. Interesting thing here is that Micah is quick to say, I'm not saying, and perhaps to counter maybe a theological justification that the false prophets are using, that what about God's eternal promise. What about God's eternal promise, right? God's, of course God's not going to, Micah's full of, you know, full of it because Micah's lying to you because that goes against God's covenant with Moses, right? Yep. With Abraham and with Moses. So this may be why Micah then goes on to say, I will surely gather all of you, Jacob. I will surely bring together the remnant of Israel. I will bring them together like sheep in a pen, like a flock in its pasture. The place will throng with people. The one who breaks open the way will go before them. They will break through the gate and go out. The king, their king will pass through before them, the Lord at their head. So there's a promise here of victory. But
He does that at the end of chapter 2, and he also does it at the end of chapter 4. So it's almost kind of like saying, this is what's going to happen, but this is not permanent because God's covenant.
Yeah, that's right. And implied here, because there's going to be a remnant and he's going to gather them. So the implication here is that they're going to be destroyed and exiled, and then after that, God's going to gather
bring them back.
So
that's right.
So that's, you know, that's how I guess Micah answers that objection about, what about God's eternal covenant? So, you know, the answer essentially is, yes, God is going to be faithful, but you won't, you know, this generation may not experience that because of
and
the
state that it's after the judgment.
Yeah, that's right.
The judgment's going to come, but then the forgiveness and the regathering will come.
That's right. Yeah. He comes back to, you know, comes back again to this justification, you know, the emphasis here then in chapter 3. Then I said, listen, you leaders of Jacob, you rulers of Israel, should you not embrace justice, you who hate good and love evil, who tear the skin from my people? And it's he escalates the language here. And for Jewish people, you know, with their food laws, and all the scruples around even touching a dead body. You know, he says, you know, you tear the skin from my people and the flesh from their bones. You eat my people's flesh, strip off their skin and break their bones, and who chop them up like meat for the pan, like flesh for the pot. I mean, man, it's
confronting.
You know, and as for the prophets who lead my people astray, they proclaim peace, you know, if they have something to eat. So this is the, you know, this is again the strong thing. And probably in some ways, particularly for Micah, this is a very strong theme, you know, for him. He's this theme of justice. You know, you despise, you distort what is right. He turns then to Jerusalem. He says, you build Zion with bloodshed and Jerusalem with wickedness. Her leaders judge for a bribe, her priests teach for a price, and her prophets tell fortunes for money. So you've got this. This is certainly happening in the south as well. But he says, by contrast, just before that, he says, but as for me, I'm filled with power, with the spirit of the Lord, with justice and might to declare Jacob his transgression, to Israel his sin. And he says, even though they do all of these things
in the Lord's name,
they say, he says here in the second part of verse 11, yet they look for the Lord's support and say, is not the Lord among us? No disaster will come upon us. You know, so, and again, it's interesting to note there, yet again, after that objection, that surely no disaster will come, but that can't happen. Again, this is the theology here, that can't happen because we're God's people and we're under eternal covenant. What does Micah say? Chapter 4, in the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as the highest of the mountains. It will be exalted above the hills and the peoples will stream to it. Many nations will come and say, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the temple of the God. So, you know, there's these grand promises, and there's a long section here. But notice what he says. In that day, declares the Lord, I will gather the lame, I will assemble the exiles and those I brought to grief. I will make the lame my remnant. You know, the lame because they've survived the battle. You know, this is those driven away, a strong note. The Lord will. So, you see here again, it's quite a consistent message. He's countering that triumphalist sort of theology that says, no, nothing's going to happen to us that can't happen.
Yeah.
He says to both Samaria, you're going to be a heap of rubble. He says down in verse 10 of chapter 4 to writhe in agony, daughter Zion, like a woman in labor. For now, you must leave the city to camp in an open field. You will go to Babylon. There you will be rescued. There the Lord will redeem you out of the hands of your enemies. Mm. So you're going to go to Babylon, but
you're going to come back. And I think also, like you said in our last episode, Matt, the prophets aren't just speaking about the immediate future. They're speaking about thousands of years into the future. And, of course, we can read the second coming of Christ here and the ruling over the, you know, of the peoples of all the world. You know,
that's right.
That's really what he's pointing all the way forward to, not just the immediate, necessarily, the immediate return from exile.
Exactly. And, of course, one of the big things, particularly for the southern kingdom, is, okay, with a city, you know, okay, the city's going to, maybe the city will be destroyed and, but, whoa, hang on, exile. No, that, because didn't God say to David, you will always have a son sitting on the throne? So that then becomes their argument. What about the Davidic covenant? And you get this sense that, you know, there was the Abrahamic covenant, you know, I will bless you and make you a blessing to all the nations of the earth. And then you've got the Mosaic covenant. I will make you a kingdom, a priest, and a holy nation if you will only serve me. I mean, there's a condition on that in the Mosaic covenant.
Yep.
But still God's favor upon the people is, you know, if you return to me, I will restore you. Mm. The Davidic covenant was focused on Judah and particularly the line of David. So you get this sense from the Abrahamic covenant to the Mosaic covenant to the Davidic covenant. And the Davidic covenant is in 2 Samuel chapter 7. Listeners can look that up.
Yeah.
The Abrahamic covenant, Genesis 12, Genesis 15, Genesis 18. The Mosaic covenant is pretty much all of the law, you know, throughout the law there in Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy, I should say, particularly Deuteronomy. The Davidic covenant, 2 Samuel chapter 7, promises this this line of David. So so Micah answers that and he says, but you, Bethlehem of Ephratah, and of course that's where Jesse and David, that's where David's family was from.
Right.
So he's speaking particularly now here to the Davidic dynasty and to this question of what about the king? Though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from of old, from ancient times. Mm. Now, the interesting thing here, he doesn't say over Judah. He's going back to the 12 tribes of Israel.
So he's not even nation.
You know, he's not even talking just about the northern kingdom there. He's actually, because he refers to Judah there. Mm. So one who will be ruler over Israel. So a reunited Israel. How is that going to happen? Because, of course, the northern kingdom go into exile and they just assimilate into the nations.
Yes.
And, of course, this is because this king is going to be ruler over the nations. And that's where actually Micah's prophecies go. You know, he points out that this king will indeed rule over all of the nations.
Yes.
So this is pointing. So it's not just, not only will you have a king over Judah, but you're going to have a king who will rule over Israel and over all the nations. By implication over all nations.
Right. I love the I'm using a NLT, I think. No, a CSB translation.
Yeah.
I love the way it says his origin is from antiquity, from eternity. You know,
which
is, you know, ancient times they use in other translations, but I just love the way that points just straight to Jesus, you know. And
I think in this context, whose origins are from old, from ancient times. I think he's talking there about the Davidic line.
Yep.
Sometimes that's taken as being talking about the pre-existence of Christ. I think that probably is reading a little bit too much theologically into the text.
Yep.
It sounds like this translation is is probably pushing a little bit for that pre-existence of Christ one.
Okay.
This is very much trying to connect this with the line of David, because the issue here actually that he wants to speak to is this issue of what about the line of David and what about the Davidic covenant. Yeah. And so it's like,
because you're kind of saying God's not going to do this because of this promise.
This king is going to have roots in that.
That's
right?
Where it's going to be.
That's the significance there. So he goes on. Again, there's a bit of back and forth through these prophecies, Stu, and you know, he goes back, he speaks more about injustice.
He talks about the Assyrian invasion of the land.
That's right. Then down in chapter,
into chapter 5, he starts to talk about the glorious and purified remnant of Jacob.
Yep. The remnant language is already projecting beyond what's it's like for Micah in particularly in the case of the northern kingdom, it's treated as though it's already going to happen.
Yeah.
And then you've got that famous verses in chapter 6.
Yeah.
You know, where he says, and again, this is for the sake of both Israel and Judah, and particularly their religiosity, and speaking to that religiosity. And perhaps their objection. Hang on, hasn't God called us to go up? He's anticipating the objection. How can you call Jerusalem a high place? How has it become a high place? And then he says in verse 6, with what shall I come before the Lord? This is verse 6 from chapter 6. Yep. With what shall I come before the Lord and bow down before the exalted God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000 rivers of olive oil? Shall I offer my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? It's an interesting verse. Interesting verse there.
Yeah.
He has shown you, O mortal, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you? To act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. Mm. It's a very famous verse from Micah. And the context of those verses is as a counter to a sort of empty religiosity, where they're going up to the dead, they're doing all the worship stuff, they're getting into the worship.
Yes.
You know, look at us, look how zealous we are. Look at how many rams we're offering, but he says, a reference to the firstborn is because, again, in that culture, in the ancient world, the greatest offering you could offer to the gods was your firstborn. Now, of course, in Genesis chapter 22, God commands Abraham offer Isaac to me. Abraham isn't surprised, interestingly, that a god would require this, because that was common practice. Yep. But the whole episode is there to say that you never, ever have to do this thing, because God himself will provide the sacrifice. And of course, as we know, God offers his firstborn in this sense for the sins, of the world. So this is, interesting little allusion there. But again, it's worth pausing here and just recognizing something about the heart of the biblical faith here. Jesus affirmed that the heart of the biblical faith is love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself, right?
Yeah.
And that, way before all of the offerings and the, all of the religiosity, he has shown you, O mortal, what is good.
Mm.
Act justly, love mercy, walk humbly with your God. That, it's the humility. It's humility, love and mercy, justice. I mean, that's it's so much at the core of the biblical ethic. So I think we'll draw this to a close, Stu, today.
Yeah.
Important, again, Micah is, even though he has a lot of harsh things to say, there is so much hope in this, in these oracles.
Mm.
Proportionately, Micah is very much a prophet of hope, even though, and this is the interesting thing, and I think this is part of the significance of the court case thing, this court case language that's used throughout this book. They lose the court case. Israel and Judah lose the court case. They are
guilty.
Absolutely guilty in the worst sense, right? Yeah. And yet, the sentence is, yes, something, you know, something is going to happen. There is, there is going to be, you know, there is going to be a sort of temporal judgment, but ultimately and beyond that, God is going to be faithful. And so
I love that part at the very end of chapter 7 from verse 18, you know, who is a God like you, removing iniquity and passing over rebellion for the remnant of his inheritance. And he talks on about God's compassion and love for his people.
Yeah, that's right.
From the covenant love.
Yeah, that's right. And so here at the end of the book, you know, the day for building your walls will come, the day for extending your boundaries. In that day, people will come to you from Assyria, the cities of Egypt, even from Egypt and the Euphrates, and from sea to sea, from mountain to mountain, the earth will become desolate because of its inhabitants as a result of their deeds. In other words, all people are going to flood to Jerusalem. And again, this is prophetic symbolism, but the idea is that, you know, the lands of the pagan gods will be drained, you know, because everyone will come, you know, people from all over the world will come and see God. It's a wonderful universal promise, you know, and he finishes here. You will again have compassion on us. You will tread our sins underfoot and hurl all our iniquities into the depths of the sea. Because remember, they've lost the court case, right? And yet Micah declares here, even though we've lost the court case, you know, as Paul says, while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. And so he says here, you will be faithful to Jacob and show love to Abraham. Interesting reference there, because the covenant with Abraham, and remember, the covenant with Abraham is that Israel will be a blessing to all the ends of the earth, will be blessed through this people. So you will be faithful to Jacob. You will show love to Abraham, and love there, chesed, very much covenant love, as you pledged on oath to our ancestors in days long ago. God's purpose is the only sure thing in the world.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Thrive Deeper. Our home on the internet is thrivetoday.tv. You can contact us, ask questions, see all our resources and much more at our website, thrivetoday.tv. We really appreciate the questions and thoughts about what you're reading as we go through the Bible with Thrive. Until next time, our prayer is that these shows will inspire you to go deeper and thrive.